This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Robert Frank is a professor of economics at Cornell. As a way of capturing his students' interest in getting them to retain the material taught, he invites them to pose and answer questions that illuminate how economic principles work in the real world. For instance, why do drive-up ATM keyboards have braille dots? On the program today, the answer to that question and others, here are a couple of others. Why do many fast food restaurants promise a free meal if you're not given a receipt at the time of purchase? Why are the least productive workers in a work group within a firm typically paid more than the value of what they produce, while the most productive workers are paid less? Robert Frank is our guest this afternoon. He is most recently the author of The Economic Naturalist, In Search of Explanations for Everyday Enigmas. Frank says learning economics is like learning a new language. And like some language instructors, he doesn't think we should get caught up in all the rules of grammar, like the pluperfect subjunctive tense. Instead, we need, in our entry into economics, the equivalent of nouns and verbs. We need to be able to communicate. We need to be able to tell stories. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Robert Frank had the help of his students in the writing of this book. Most of the essays in the book were inspired by his students' questions. Half of the royalties of the book, therefore, will benefit the John S. Knight Institute for Writing in the Disciplines at Cornell. Robert Frank's previous books include Luxury Fever and The Winner-Take-All Society. You'll find more information about our guest and his books, including The Economic Naturalist, at our guest's website, www.robert-h-frank.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Robert Frank, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on your show.
My pleasure. So let's start there with that first question that I led off with in my introduction. What's the answer to the question, why do drive-up ATM machines have braille dots?
Yeah, that question, Celeste, was submitted by my students, Bill Joa, in 1997. It's one of my all-time favorites, really. It's a good question because, obviously, the people who drive up to the cash machines can see perfectly well. Why do they need braille dots on the keypads? Mm-hmm. And Bill Joa's hypothesis was that, look, they're going to make the machines with braille dots on the keypads for the walk-up locations. Once they've gone to the trouble to do that, why not make all the machines the same way? It would just be a lot more trouble and expense to keep two separate inventories and make sure that the right machines went to the right destinations. And so, you know, if the driver has really suffered any inconvenience from the braille dots being on the keypad buttons, that'd be one thing. But, you know, nobody minds them. And so it's just cheaper. So he gave a nice, simple explanation in economic terms for what I think everybody agrees is a pretty interesting question. And that's the essence of the assignment. You know, if they would all be that good, my job would be easy. You know, they're not all that good, but many of them are pretty close.
Yeah, and if only textbooks were written like this, in school, I think we'd absorb a lot more information than we currently do.
What's distressing, now we have evidence, Celeste, that if you give basic economics students who've taken the standard Econ 101 course, a test to measure how much they've retained of their knowledge of basic economic principles 6 months after the course, give them this test, and they don't score any better than students who never took the course at all. You know, it's an astonishingly dismal performance, these courses. And I think what we do typically is we've got these huge encyclopedic texts. We want to be rigorous. We want to be comprehensive. So the professors ask themselves, how much can I cover? You know, and if they cover a lot, they feel like, wow, I did a good job. I covered a ton of material today. But that's just not the right question. You know, the human mind can wrap itself around only so much at a sitting, and you really want to ask how much can they take away from the room today, and try to tailor the material and the form that's easiest for them to absorb and actually work with themselves. If you really think about the course that way, you get something that looks very different from the standard mix of equations and graphs and hundreds of concepts. Yeah, you really pare it down. You repeat a lot. As you said in your intro, it's really trying to mimic the process that a child goes through learning to speak her native language. You know, you don't have complicated grammar and tenses thrown at people by their parents. They just, you know, here, repeat after me. Here, do this. And that's the way they learn.
Yeah. Later in the book, there's a chapter, Decoding Marketplace Signals, and this is one of the questions from that chapter, and I find that it is a fascinating question, and I think it goes also to what we've been talking about just now. The question is this: why do humanities professors, who should be more adept than most in their use of language, often write so unclearly?
Oh, yeah, that question arose because a couple of years ago, Celeste, I took a seminar. I was a participant in a seminar in which the university gave professors some time off to meet and discuss ideas with one another. And their goal in that seminar was to mix up people from the humanities and the social sciences, try to get a dialogue going. And so the format was each of us would take turns leading a discussion on some specific topic, and we would assign readings. And the humanists assigned articles that I just found very difficult to read. And this was surprising to me. The ones who were in that field, almost all of them got 800s on their SAT verbal. They're very skillful verbally. So why is it that they write so unclearly? There was one particular assignment that caught my eye. The article was called Tactical Strategies of the Streetwalker. It was by a woman by the name of Maria Lugones. And if you've got a moment, I'll just read a paragraph from
it. I would love to hear you read this, because I thought if I read this out loud, I don't know if I could get through it.
And I want to say I didn't choose this paragraph in particular. It was almost one that I could have picked at random from the article. So you hear the title of the article, Tactical Strategies of the Streetwalker, and you want to know, wow, what are they? But then you start reading, and here's the verbatim quote from the passage that I took. I propose to embrace tactical strategies in moving in disruption of the dichotomy, comma, as crucial to an epistemology of resistance / liberation, full stop. To do so is to give uptake to the disaggregation of collectivity concomitant with social fragmentation, and to theorize the navigation of its perils without giving uptake to its logic.
Hmm.
Full stop.
What the heck does that mean?
Yeah, and you finish that, and you have, or at least I have absolutely no sense what is going on here. And I had a friend come join our faculty at Cornell. I told him about this example. He said, oh, here, let me see that. I took a bunch of humanities courses. I'll tell you what that means. And he read it, and he looked up, and he read it a second time, and then he just shook his head. He had no clue what was going on here. So that's interesting. Why is it these people who obviously have very deep verbal skills, why do they write in this language that's impenetrable to people?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. And my hypothesis is that they probably did write in plain English at one point in academic history, and then someone discovered that by throwing in an unfamiliar word or phrase, the environment was getting more competitive, you'd get a leg up. And so people would read this unfamiliar word or phrase and say, wow, the author is erudite. She knows something that I don't. And so you scored points by doing that. And it still didn't make the article sound silly because you only did a little bit of it. But then others started to throw that in too. And gradually, step by step, it escalated. And so now here's the equilibrium level of discourse. You know, you can see why an individual professor might profit by doing that. Maybe that's what you need to be able to do to get tenure at a research university. But it's really not a good way to talk or write, I don't think. I mean, you wouldn't want somebody teaching your freshman how to write who's writing like that.
Yeah. And to be fair, there are humanities professors who, of course, communicate beautifully on the page as well.
Of course, yeah.
As verbally. And, you know, my husband and I have talked about this from time to time as we have to do a lot of reading. And It's like, I have made the hypothesis, and I think you've confirmed it in part, that it's a little bit like joining a club. And you
you're trying to show you know the lingo.
You know the lingo.
You're really part of the in fraternity. And in fairness, you know, I don't single out only humanities. I think this is really quite common as a phenomenon. So in the same chapter, I've got an example about the use of excessive mathematical formalism in economics. Again, if you're one of a pair of competing job applicants, it's always advantageous in economics to be more rigorous than the other competitor. And so we've seen, I think, a pretty intense arms race, people trying to get more rigorous. And so now the level of discourse is just forbiddingly technical in many of the economics journals.
Yeah.
It's more mysterious than that paragraph I just read to you.
Yeah, and even if you go back to the high school level or even earlier in school, I think students would benefit if a similar approach to your economic naturalist was adopted by other disciplines. So science and math come to mind.
I went through my – one of my sons was taking the AP calculus course a couple of years ago at Ithaca High School, and I went through the book with him, and I just couldn't believe how overly difficult it was. There was just no way a student who'd never had calculus could take a course from that book and not be bewildered. And I know all the students, many of them very bright in his class, struggled with it, and I don't think most of them ever came away with a real intuitive sense of what calculus does. It's a great tool for thinking about things in the world, but you know they would never have really realized that from that book.
Hmm. Why do you call the writing assignment you give to your students the economic naturalist?
Ah, good question. It's inspired, I think, by biology courses I took as a high school and college student. I think if you've talk to people who've taken a good course in evolutionary biology, they'll all tell you that it just opens their eyes to all sorts of interesting patterns and texture in the environment, things they wouldn't notice if they hadn't had that background knowledge. And I think it's really the same in economics. If you have good mastery of about four or five or six principles, there's nowhere you can go. There's no store you can go to. There's no party you can go to. There's no sports event you can go to where you won't see some of these principles in action, helping explain the structure of the products you see, the design features, the behavior of the people involved trying to sell them. It all becomes more interesting just on the basis of a few principles. So really, I want them to be naturalists in that same sense that the field biologist is one.
Yeah. Well, we talked about the ATM. Maybe we could take another look at a product design feature or features and how economic principles inform design. I like this one. Why is milk sold in rectangular containers while soft drinks are sold in round ones?
Yeah, that's a question that's drawn a lot of very spirited commentary on various blogs. The answer suggested in the example is that in the supermarkets, they store soft drinks on unrefrigerated shelves. The space on those shelves is much less costly than the space in the refrigerated containers where milk has to be stored. There's wasted shelf space if you use a cylindrical container. And so in the refrigerated containers, which are the boxes where they store milk, those are so expensive that they don't really see it as a sensible thing to waste any shelf space so they can get the maximum amount of milk cooled in a given refrigerator unit by having the cross-section of the container be square rather than cylindrical. Now, a lot of people have leapt to point out that in addition, the soda cans want to be cylindrical because that helps contain the pressure from the carbonated beverage inside. That's a fair point.
Mm-hmm.
It would be cheaper, though, to make milk containers cylindrically, too. That's the cheapest design of a container. If all you're worried about is having enough strength to contain the volume inside, the cylindrical container use less material than you would with a square one. Why don't they make the milk containers cylindrical? And I think the suggestion that you're economizing on very expensive shelf space still helps pull an oar there. It gets you a little closer to the right answer.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too. Now, when we go home with our soda pop, we might carry it in fridge packs, which makes our refrigerator more efficient in terms of what we can put in there and how we store it?
You know, I've not seen those. I don't even know what a fridge pack of soda is.
Oh, okay. Then you've got your round cans packaged in rectangular cardboard containers.
Oh.
And there's a slit, a perforated slit in there. When you get it home, you put it on the shelf in the refrigerator, and you open that spot, and you just it fits tidily, very, very tidy. It fits in one corner of the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
And you just reach in and pull one can out at a time. You don't have to deal with the rings on a six-pack. So I can't remember now how many cans come in a fridge pack, maybe 24? I'm not sure. I'm conferring with my technical director, Jason Kraft. So let's take a call now. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, economist Robert H. Frank, his latest book, The Economic Naturalist, In Search of Explanations for Everyday Enigmas. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. You can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener online for someone calling in this afternoon from Eureka. Hi.
Hi. Interesting program. I'd like to ask maybe a little bit larger question. I don't know if that's within the scope, but it always kind of, I get lost in the economic explanations. How does the balance of trade deficit and the current federal deficit, which I believe is approaching something like 250 billion people, how does that affect people in their everyday lives?
Yeah, that's a good question. Those kinds of questions aren't really the focus of the book, but they're incredibly important questions too. I'm focused, and my students are, more on the kinds of things that they run into as they go about their everyday business. Of course, they read about these deficits in the newspaper, and one quick response to your question is that if we're borrowing money year after year, that's an unsustainable trajectory, really, the same as it would be for a family. We're now borrowing about $800 billion from abroad to finance the fact that we're consuming more imports than we're selling of our exports. And when the federal government borrows money to cover its deficit, the net effect of all that is that we end up having very low savings in the economy. The last 2 years running, we've had negative savings rates, which means that people are actually spending more than they earn, the difference being made up, of course, by borrowing. And you just can't do that over any extended period. That hasn't happened, really, since the first years of the Great Depression. And so I think one of the jobs of the next administration is going to be to try and set all that right. We just can't allow those deficits to keep piling up.
Could I ask one more question?
Sure.
Please. Do you know who are the biggest holders of American debt? Is it like China and Germany and Saudi Arabia, South Korea? Is that accurate?
Those are all big holders. Japan would be near the top of that list as well.
If they ever called in the debt at the same time, would we be in big trouble?
We'd be in big trouble indeed. But fortunately for us, if they try to call in the debt all at once, they'd be in big trouble too. The dollar would crash even more rapidly than it's been crashing. They're holding debt denominated in dollars, and so they would be cutting the legs out from under the value of the debt they hold. So, yeah, we're kind of in a bind together, but it's clear that they've gotten a lot more reluctant to hold U.S. debt, and many of them are starting to transfer to the euro and the pound. So I think, yeah, the day of reckoning is at hand. We really need to do something about this.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Other questions are invited. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. I guess what we're talking about here today is the world of microeconomics rather than the world of macro.
Yeah, it's much more micro-oriented. And Ben Bernanke, who's now the Fed chairman, he and I wrote a Principles of Economics textbook in the late 90s. It came out for the first edition in the year 2000. He wrote the macro component of our textbook, and we do have an economic naturalist sequence of examples in it as well. And there the examples are really much more of the sort that the caller just asked about, things you read about in the newspaper, things that are affecting the whole economy as opposed to you personally.
Yeah.
Let's take that. You because they affect the whole economy.
Yeah. Well, let's come back to that issue of savings, though, on the microeconomic level, perhaps, here okay. in a moment. But let's take a call. Got another listener waiting to call, talk to us, I think, here in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is, does age make a difference? I know it has in me. As I get older, I get really slower. Anyhow, I haven't read your book, but I'm really looking forward to it. And I'll hang up and listen to
okay,
your...
Okay, well, for clarification, age in terms of being a consumer in the world of economics, or what
or being able to read the book?
Yeah, well, age period, does it make a difference in learning?
In learning?
Yes.
Well, sure it does. I mean, toddlers can't do what a six-year-old can. I mean, there's a maturation process, obviously, and with age, we lose some gray cells. Yeah, I have trouble remembering people's names more often than I used to. But basically, what the neuroscientists are telling us now is that you can continue to lay down new brain circuits well into advanced age. I know I've talked to lots of people in their 90s who have read this book and enjoyed it. What really pleased me was somebody reviewed the book on his blog and said he'd enjoyed it and agreed with the thesis. But then he added that when he was putting his 11-year-old son to bed each night, he had started telling him about some of these examples, and he just couldn't get out of the room. His son kept asking for more examples. So, you know, here we have college freshmen who are really much more far along cognitively in terms of their preparation. They can't get anything permanent to stick in the freshman economics course as it's usually taught. And then we see side by side an 11-year-old who just has suddenly become curious about economics and is going to remember a lot of that. So I think we're just going about it the wrong way. Yeah. You know, we evolved as storytellers, as a species. You know, it wasn't our impulse in the Pleistocene age to grab a twig and start sketching equations and graphs in the dirt. You know, we told stories. That's how information naturally gets into the brain most easily.
Yeah.
You know, just slides in like a key into a lock. And yeah. we got to get the students telling stories more about what they see. I think that's really the key to them taking something away that'll last.
Yeah. Instead of drawing you a graph, I got to tell you, there's a bear up the way, and we got to get out of here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Let's take another call. A listener on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hi. Occasionally I run into young people, students, college students, liberals always, that complain about the World Bank and so on. And I agree with them in a lot of ways, but I say you really should go take an economics course and learn about purchasing power parity and about comparative advantage. And then I try to explain these concepts to them, and I get all muddled up. And as far as I know, the ones I've checked with have never taken that economics course, and so they don't have the understanding that we all should have of international economics and what's going on in the news. What would you advise a student to do? What would you advise me to tell students to do to kind of take a quick naturalistic view of some of these important concepts? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. It's a good question. I think the main thing is to draw people in. You know, the way the course is traditionally taught, it's as if we have a captive audience. They've just got to take our course as a requirement, and we don't care whether they like it or not. When I've pointed out to colleagues these studies that show that we don't leave any lasting trace on our students, they say, oh, no, that's not right. When we get them in the intermediate microeconomics course, they recognize the concepts more quickly because they've already seen them once in the introductory course. Well, okay, maybe that's true, but is that really something to crow about? Is that the best we can do? Most of them don't take the advanced course because they didn't like the introductory course. So I would say somebody, if you have a son or daughter you want to interest in this, I would say read any of the good books that are out there now. I like mine, but I'll also recommend Tim Harford has a book called The Undercover Economist that goes into explanations for things that you see in the world in economic terms. The book that really opened the door to a much wider interest in this whole notion was Freakonomics. They've sold, I think, now 2 million copies of that book. Get people to start looking at things in a cost-benefit framework. And, you know, once they get the knack of that, they're going to want to do more. They're going to want to take the international economics course. They're going to want to read further. If they don't like their first pass at it, then, you know, you've lost them, basically.
The cost-benefit principle, would it be accurate to say that's the one that sits at the base of it all?
That's the granddaddy of them all, for sure. I say there's half a dozen. I wouldn't try to teach anyone half a dozen principles in 45 minutes, but I think you really can master one, and that would be the one I would choose. It's the explanation, really, for the Braille dots question. The cost-benefit principle, plain, commonsensical, short statement. It just says, do it if the benefits exceed the cost. Otherwise, don't do it. Who could argue with that? The Braille dots belong there because they reduce the cost of getting the machines delivered to the different locations compared to the alternative of having two separate inventories. They don't alter the benefit of the machines for anyone, so it's clearly better to do it that way from a cost-benefit perspective. Yeah, and you could just answer any number of questions. That's the most commonly invoked principle in the examples that my students submit.
Mm. Is there a link between cost-benefit principle and opportunity cost?
Opportunity cost is a very important concept in economics. I think people often lose sight of costs that they incur if they don't have to write a check or hand over some cash to people. So if we say, what's the opportunity cost of listening to this program this afternoon? Well, I hope you're a contributor to the station. It's a listener-supported station. But if you've already contributed, you're not going to contribute more just because you listen this afternoon. So there's really no monetary outlay that you have to make to listen to this program. On the other hand, you do have to give up doing whatever else you were doing, or at least you're going to multitask and maybe do whatever else you were doing a little less efficiently than you were. And so you're giving something up. And so it's the value of what you give up that we want to highlight in this concept of opportunity cost. It includes the value of all those things you couldn't do because you're doing this. So if you don't understand opportunity cost, then you're not going to be able to employ the cost-benefit principle to decide whether to do something. You're not going to measure the costs and benefits correctly, and that's really the main problem people have in making decisions. They don't recruit the relevant information to compare the right costs and benefits when they're trying to decide.
Yeah. Well, let's bring a real-world example into this story. One of the reasons that the average age at first marriage has increased has to do with opportunity cost.
That's a good point. This was in a chapter in the book on personal relationships, and I think it's a great subject for student papers because there's nothing more on the minds of freshmen than the relationships they're trying to kindle with romantic partners. And so all those examples, I think, are really extremely effective in terms of the interest factor that they generate among students. So one question was, why are people waiting 2 or 3 years later to marry now compared to 10 or 15 years ago? And there are a number of interesting hypotheses about that. One is that because we're so much more mobile now, that if you fail to marry the first attractive person you meet, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to come across somebody just as attractive or more attractive in the next few years. When people were much more stationary in terms of their economic mobility, one strategy that people often followed was to marry the first person who's acceptable who comes along, lest someone else capture that person before you do. Now people are content to wait because we know there are going to be more opportunities. It's also more costly to marry young now. The opportunity cost of becoming a parent young is higher now just because so much more education is required to function in today's labor market. You have a much harder time getting your degree if you marry first and start having children than if you postpone that activity.
Yeah, and I suppose another example of opportunity cost could be if a student at Cornell or here at the University of Illinois is thinking about, you know, taking the summer courses or going home to work.
Right.
What does it cost me to take this statistics course this summer as opposed to how much I could earn at home over the next two and a half months?
Right. I think if you're just if you're just thinking about the cost of the statistics course as the tuition they're going to charge you, you're missing really a very important component of the cost. You're giving up, as you point out, also the opportunity to go home and earn money during the summer. That's not a check you write to anybody, but it's a cost all the same. Mm. It's money that you would have had that you now won't have if you stay in Urbana, Champaign, and take the statistics course.
Robert Frank is our guest this afternoon. He's a professor of economics at Cornell. He is the author most recently of The Economic Naturalist in Search of Explanations for Everyday Enigmas. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Actually, just as a side note, when I taught her, excuse me, a research course, I used to refer to it as sadistics. and because they were not, that's a course.
That's another tough one, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, the reality is, if you have good examples and you can do it, you can actually work the students into it, that kind of
thing. Absolutely, yeah. And so many courses don't do that. Mm-hmm. The courses just give them a lot of math and then they can't read an article about a study published in the newspaper and realize what the authors failed to do right.
Yeah, one way I used to involve them is that would take their test scores and then would randomly assign them and show them in terms of the t-test that there would be no significant difference between the scores. So it was something that they could relate.
Uh-huh.
Actually, the concept I always liked, and I don't know whether it applies in here, it was value added. And I guess I get concerned about our economy at times that with manufacturing, there's more value added than I think in a lot of, certainly in maybe services something, but I guess I see more in manufacturing. But you want to comment on that?
Yeah, the value you add is how much more valuable is the thing you're selling after you're done with it than when it came to you. So if you're flipping hamburgers, well, a raw hamburger and a bun that's not prepared won't fetch the same price in a restaurant. Nobody even want to buy it as it would if it were all cooked and ready to go. But there's no real distinction between adding value in manufacturing and adding it in some other way. A comedian tells a joke that makes you happy. The experience of enjoying the joke is something you value. You'd be willing to pay for it. People do pay for it. They pay to go to clubs, and that's value added too. So I think it's a common misconception that the only real value added is when we make products. Services of all types are real value added too.
But sometimes, just in terms of, let's say, the bank, the banking industry, or where, what's this other one that's up for criticism now, that they only pay 15% tax.
Yeah, the hedge fund managers and the private equity fund managers.
But, I mean, when we took that notion that some of these salaries of, especially even in the case of CEOs, $70 million, do they add that much value to a corporation?
It's a lot more money than anybody needs. I think everyone's pretty clear on that. And if everybody earned a tenth as much, most of them still be willing to work pretty hard to hold those positions.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at a really big organization and ask how much better off will the organization be if it gets a leader that's slightly better, who's slightly better than the next best one, the answer is going to be always a huge number. We just hired a president at Cornell. His main job, David Scorton's his name, his main job is going to be to preside over Cornell's newly announced $4.3 billion capital campaign.
Mm-hmm.
If he's 2% better than the next best guy or woman would have been at presiding over the capital campaign, we're talking about 40-odd million, $43 million difference to the bottom line. If he's 3% better, it's a really big number.
Yeah, good
and
point.
So,
thank you.
Yeah, that's value added from the university's perspective.
Okay, let's take another call. Another listener in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And your comment I just heard was a fabulous description of how economics can tell a big story in a way that's really meaningful and exciting. I was going back to a comment you made about how dry most presentations are, not only in economics, but when I was in business school, learning about marketing, accounting, production, so forth, it was very boring. And I have since been in the business world and on both sides, the for-profit and the not-for-profit. And I can think of so many more exciting ways to present what I learned those years in business school.
Yeah, it's funny that they do it in marketing, isn't it? Because they, of all people, ought to know that you really only have your listener's ear for a short time. You better make the best of your opportunity. And yet so many times they don't.
Absolutely. I would encourage you to get more academics to hear your theories about communicating in a way that makes it exciting for young people.
Okay, here's what you do. You call all your friends and send them emails, tell them they need to read The Economic Naturalist.
I'm going to buy it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we take a call from a listener in St. Charles, line 4. Hi.
Good afternoon. How is everybody today?
Fine.
Good.
How are you?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. You know, I'm listening to all this stuff, and I'm a small business owner, and you know, my concern right now is I want to see how you feel about the economy and how things are going forward. I'm hearing mixed, I don't know, I guess I don't understand why the stock market people and all these other bigwigs say it's doing just fine when I'm at a lower level and I'm seeing the opposite. I'm seeing a lot of people going in foreclosures. I'm looking at companies starting to feel the pinch, and to me, the economy, I don't know, I just don't understand the economics and the economy anymore. It's just, it's to me, if you're a small business, anybody making less than $100,000 a year anymore, I don't see it. I see that there's more of us paying out more money to live and, you know, to support the company than there is, you know, say someone at a bigger company. I don't know. Maybe I'm looking at this wrong.
No, I don't think you are. In fact, that you give me the perfect opportunity to plug the other book of mine that just was published on July 9th. It's called Falling Behind, How Rising Income Inequality Harms the Middle Class. And it's really all about what you just asked about. That's not what this book's about, but there are books about it, and I think your observations are on target. Yeah, there's a lot of debt out there that's very shaky, and anybody who feels really confident that we're on firm footing, I think, isn't reading the picture correctly.
I think some of it, though, is lack of common sense, though. I mean, there should be a class on common sense because, you know, where I'm at, this is my third house. I've actually fourth. The first one I had was a trailer, but I've been married for 30 years. I started from an apartment building, went to a trailer, went to a smaller house. In other words, I've kind of stepped up to where I'm at now. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these people, I'm finding that they're building $600,000, $700,000, $800,000 homes. People have no money down when they go to buy it. Right. And I think that's where they're getting cut. Why can't they just, you know, look at it and say, well, let's start here at the, you know, somewhere in between or
right.
less.
Mm.
We're our own downfalls, the way I look at it. And economically speaking, I'm trying to be, you know, it doesn't take economics 101 to figure that one out. But I do appreciate you guys having a discussion on this, by the way. It's long and short and coming. But I'll definitely pick up your other book. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Maybe you want to mention just briefly the phenomenon of the Victoria's Secret fantasy bra here. I mean, isn't that a good example of what we're talking about a little bit?
Yeah, this was Stephanie Wenstrup's question, and what Victoria's Secret does and has been doing now for about a decade is at Christmas time they'll put in the catalog one really expensive gift item, and it's been a jewel-studded brassiere, and they'll milk it for all the publicity it's worth. So they'll typically send a model wearing the garment full of diamonds and sapphires. She'll be carried in a Brinks car to Harry Winston Jeweler. That was the year that Winston was the designer of this particular undergarment. And then she'll step out of the armored car and open her blazer, and the cameras, flash bulbs will be going off. they get a lot of attention from this, but when I asked, nobody's ever bought one of these garments. They sit in the catalog. The most expensive of them have been over $12 million. What's going on here? Why are they offering these items for sale every year if no one's buying them? It's a plausible hypothesis that they get so much mileage in terms of publicity from the escalating value of these garments. You know, they're always more expensive, or almost always more expensive one year or the next. And so the media keep showing up to cover the event. And when a husband sees this $12 million bra in the catalog, he'll say, oh, some chump's buying that. I'm not a fool. But then he'll see a $300 undergarment next to it on the page. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm a frugal guy. I'm going to get my wife that $300 undergarment, which suddenly to him seems cheap
right.
when it's viewed side by side against a $12 million garment.
Yeah, spending money to save money.
It's a good marketing tactic.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Listener in Sycamore, line one. Hi.
Hi. I really enjoyed your program, and I want to return to an item you brought up earlier about national debt. And the fact that a lot of countries hold U.S. debt and are becoming less willing to hold it. And if that's so, how come our interest rates are not rising? You would think if we're having trouble borrowing from these nations that it would be we'd have to pay higher interest rates to attract their money.
That's a great question, and it's one that economists have been scratching their heads about for the last several years. Why is it that interest rates aren't rising? And there's a lot of capital loose in the world looking for some place to go, and a lot of it's been coming into our stock market here, and that's been essentially what's been covering those deficits. We do see now, though, some stirrings. The interest rates are starting to move a little bit at the end of the term structure. So I don't think anybody feels confident that it won't happen. But, yeah, it's a great question that you ask.
Well, it's interesting that all the strategy bulletins that I get from my broker are saying interest rates are going down and that you should buy now because they're only going to get less in the future. And I said, I sure don't see it that way.
No, they're not going down. And, in fact, Alan Greenspan urged customers to take out adjustable rate mortgages a couple of years ago, hoping to squeeze one last little bit of expansion out of the housing cycle. And he knew perfectly well that interest rates were at a point where they were no way going to go lower and would probably go up and probably go up before too long. So I think, there are a lot of people who are going to see their mortgages forfeited in the coming years because of sort of getting extended on adjustable rate mortgages at a time when it really didn't make sense to do that.
Well, it sounds like he was giving bad advice.
In my humble opinion. My co-author in my textbook is the current Fed chairman. He's not responsible for anything I say. I want to be clear. That's my opinion. I'm not speaking for him.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Well, let's wind up here with a question about savings. Why aren't we doing more of it?
Yeah, that's a question I take up in Falling Behind. And it's puzzling, you know. The rich people in any society typically save at higher rates than the poor people. That's been true forever. And what's been happening in the U.S. for the last 30 years is that most of the income gains have been going to people at the top of the income ladder. And so if you think about that, wow, it sounds like we ought to be having a higher savings rate. But in fact, we're having a lower savings rate year by year for the last 15 years. What's going on? The simplest, most plausible explanation I've managed to come up with is that no matter which group you're in, even if you're rich, if we look at the subgroup you're in, so maybe you're a hedge fund manager, maybe you're a private equity firm manager, maybe you're a CEO, what's happened in the last 30 years is that the principal economic gains in your group, if you're a real estate agent, if you're a shoe salesman, it just doesn't matter. If you're a college graduate, if you're an engineer, however we define your group, it's the people at the top of your group who've been getting the big gains. The people in the middle have had very modest gains, and in many groups, the people at the bottom have actually lost ground economically. So no matter which group you're in, you've fallen behind in relative terms the people at the top of your group. And it's always the spending at the top of a group that sets the stage for what defines people, the goods and services people think are attractive or desirable or necessary to have. So the really rich build bigger mansions. That affects the frame of reference for people who are almost really rich. Right. And it cascades all the way down.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Professor Frank, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Robert H. Frank, he is the author of The Economic Naturalist in Search of Explanations for Everyday Enigmas. That's the book we've been talking about today. He's also got another new book out called Falling Behind. He's also the author of Luxury Fever and The Winner-Take-All Society. You can find more information about our guest and his books at his website, www.robert-h-frank.com. And our thanks this afternoon to the folks at Cornell, where our guest is a professor of economics. He's a professor of economics at Cornell. And there in the studio at Cornell, our thanks go to Technical Director Bert Reed.